Well, hey, everybody, this is Dave. Making a couple of quick comments and then two responses to questions at this point, and then I want to hear from you. So based on the questions and objectives you've sent in, thanks so much for your responses, I've added a couple of brief case studies for this seminar particularly, and hope it will address several of the questions at once. Now, I realize when I don't follow my own outline, it may at times be confusing, but I promise I'll incorporate everything, at least that I think is important, and rely on you to highlight things that you want to add. And I mention this, I want to reiterate, because this addresses two or three of the comments that you sent in. Look at my last blog. It's at mentorpath.com, mentorpath.com. The top tab toward the right end is blog, and it's the first blog. It's called How Can You Help Someone Change Their Mind? And I think that will be helpful, especially in light of what we're talking about. The couple of comments that I want to make. Remember that each of your clients do not experience their story as a story. This is our metaphor. As coaches, they experience it just as the way things are. Margaret Atwood said it really clearly in Alias Grace. She said, when you're in the middle of a story, it isn't a story at all, but only a confusion, a dark roaring, a blindness, a wreckage of shattered glass and splintered wood. Now, hopefully it's way better when we're co-creating a new story with a client. But only in retrospect do our lives have a clear linear path as a series of episodes that have a beginning, middle, and end, and only in retrospect does it seem a story rather than just day to day. But when you think about it, this is exactly what we're doing with our clients, because we're creating a model in how we interact with them about how to develop self-empathy, how to take the client's point of reference in their own story, as author of that story, to self-reflect and to evaluate. They're downloading the model of what we provide the entire time, even while we're talking about other stuff. And I think it's very analogous to the way that our kids are downloading a model of how to regard everything from relationships to emotion to money story, how to take care of yourself. They're downloading a model while we as parents and they as kids are talking about really different stuff. Same with our clients. So thoughts or questions in addition to what you've already sent in, again, I appreciate that, or any comments at this point before we move into our discussion for this seminar on mastering states of mind. Any thoughts, reflections, anything you want to add or ask or even just comment on? Anyone? If not, let me add. If there are things that you would like to talk about or discuss more, or any vignettes or illustrations, let's plan to add like 10 or 15 minutes at the end of our fourth seminar, after the top of the hour, just to have a discussion, because I want to be sure that we're covering all the things that may be important or relevant to you, or things that maybe were questions raised during our seminars that weren't completely answered or that you're not quite sure about, and we can talk about. So plan to add that time after the fourth seminar so that we can discuss. So final call for any additional comments, questions, hellos. Okay, I'll take care of myself, but I want you to know I'm getting a little lonely here, so I'm going to reserve some time at the end for any questions or comments or clarification. So I'll meet you on the other side. Okay, in talking about, I think, what is the most important variable to determine success, the mastery of regulating states of mind. Because a mindset boots up an entire framework, an entire software program to deal with something. And there are many software programs that we have. So a state of mind is a mind-body state, analogous to a specific software program that determines how we perceive and how we process information and respond. A state of mind is a whole set of particular emotions, memories, mental models, behavioral patterns. So a key element in mentor coaching may be, especially for some clients, to help them become aware of states of mind and learn how to address getting grounded, centered, so that they have access to all the information in all of their states of mind. Because any altered state, for example, anxiety, excitement, worry, anything can skew a focus to a specific software program rather than the whole search engine capacity of being grounded and centered and having access to all of thoughts, feelings, all the ways of being. So here's an illustration, kind of goofy illustration, but it's vivid, of how states of mind are like different software packages. If you take a rat, put it in a maze, and teach it to get to the cheese, it can get to the cheese again and again. Now, if before you teach that rat to get to the cheese, you inject it with just a little bit of amphetamine, you alter the state slightly. Teach to get to the cheese, it can go again and again. Now, if you take away the amphetamine, the rat can't get to the cheese. It can have in its brain the patterns of how to get to the cheese, but it can't access it, and it can literally die of starvation in that maze. You re-inject the amphetamine, it immediately goes to the cheese. Now, this is an example of two distinct states of mind without any overlap. Probably the most analogous to this in real life are maybe post-traumatic stress disorder, maybe even multiple personality disorder. But think about a common example. When you try to think of somebody's name and can't, you know that person's name. It's on the tip of your tongue, but you don't recall it. Later, you're in a more relaxed state or you're thinking about something else and boom, it comes. You have access to that state of mind. So when I say a state of mind is a mind-body state, like a specific software program, it determines how we perceive, process information, and respond. And each of us has a range of states. The awareness of what state works best for which endeavor, even of how to enter and exit states, is important because we want to enter the state of mind that has the whole pattern of how to respond. Think about a pro athlete who has practiced years and years, enters a performance flow. If for 1 second that person stops to think about something, I was working with an Olympic athlete about to compete, and she noticed that something was a little bit off, and we went through frame by frame, and she noticed that for a second before she performed, she would look at her primary opponent and wonder how she was going to do. That's the essence of a choke, to think about it instead of stay in that performance flow. What we want to do is to get totally grounded and centered, to be able to focus entirely on the conversation with our client and to stay in that state and that immersion, that contingent conversation for the entire time. So it's helpful to know, for example, what state to enter for a creative endeavor, what state to enter for maybe conceptual planning, what works best to go to sleep more effectively. We're going to come back to that. But let me offer a case illustration that I think will maybe address some questions, but illustrate this because it's the origin, it's the initial case where I hatched the idea of the neural conditioning chart. And you can see more of that. There's on my homepage of my website, at the very bottom, there's a 30-minute free webinar called Master States of Mind. And you'll see on it a neural conditioning chart, how to basically change your brain wiring for emotional triggers. And this is what launched this. I'll call her Barbara. Barbara paused in one of our mentor coaching sessions. We were working on her executive leadership, and she mentioned almost parenthetically that she would be distracted over, at that time, the upcoming Thanksgiving holidays and look forward to getting back and resuming her new project at her company and had been doing terrifically well in new and creative ways. And I sensed her momentary discomfort at that and asked her about her expectations of the holidays. She mentioned that she's aware of a pattern that she goes home for one major holiday a year, kind of rotates, but same thing happens. She notices the same problem. She described what she observed with some reluctance and embarrassment. And basically she said, we have a big family gathering where my parents, brother and sister, and their families all come together for a holiday weekend, usually 3 days. I resolve before I leave that this time is going to be different. This time I will not get into arguments or struggles are mad exchanges with my parents and brother and sister. I focus intensely on staying balanced, not resorting to the squabbles and upset. I can usually last most of the first day, and then something happens and I lose it every time. I get in a fight with one of my family, which then escalates. I'm in a fight with all of them. Then we're at a standoff for the rest of the holiday time. This does not happen except when I'm there with them. This has never happened in the boardroom. This has never happened at my company. I can maintain my cool all other times, even with telephone visits with them. But in person, I lose it. Is there anything you can do to help me with this? And at first, again, my empathic resonance, or attempt to, I reflected on how frustrating this must be for her to want an enjoyable holiday with her family and have things work out otherwise. And she heartily agreed. I said, at the time you're in the middle of that upset and in that argument with them, what's the age of that conversation? And she did not need me to explain that question. Early adolescence, I'm 13 or 14 instantly and totally at that time, and I'm stuck there for the rest of the visit. Barbara wanted a close, meaningful relationship with her parents and sibs. She understandably wanted to share her personal and professional successes and experiences and hear about the same from her siblings and about the transitions her parents had made. But in a state that was triggered by emotion, she only wanted to be right, to be heard, to express her, and she was 13 or 14 all over again. I asked her specifically what she was aware of that triggered her reactions. And she began to talk globally. I said, no, specifically, what do you notice? She began to look then and noticed, well, there's a particular look from her dad. There's a word her mother uses that just instantly sets her, a gesture from her brother that would create that state change to her reactive mode and all that adolescent turmoil. For example, when her dad rolled his eyes, she was instantly back in that time capsule of anger and resentment, feeling controlled and criticized by him, not being good enough, expecting negative judgment. So I recommended that she schedule a time, an appointment with herself, where there's no interruptions, no cell phone, no text, but she gets totally focused and in a state where she can observe this, not to get triggered by any of the specific recollections, but to observe it and to write a list of each of the emotional triggers that she was aware of with each member of her family. Again, to observe and not let it be triggering. We call this column one, emotional trigger. You'll see in the webinar. So I emphasize that she remained grounded and centered when she did this, to be the observer, to not reenter that state. Then I suggested for each emotional trigger in column one, she do a column two. These are three vertical lines on a page. Column two was her usual immediate response, thoughts, feelings, behaviors. And for her, it was negative self-talk. They were all automatic reactions to the emotional trigger. This was her age 13 time capsule, and she would instantly have the state change and enter that time capsule and feel stuck for the rest of the holiday. Now, I suggested that she schedule a second brainstorming session with herself, maybe at least 24 hours later, to think of a mantra to get centered and present for each emotional trigger. This was column three. A mantra consists of three parts. A cue to initiate the process. And she used the cue of touching her ring. A focus phrase to align the energy field of her brain. Hers was relaxed and powerful. And a physiology such as a deep breath for relaxation, to breathe in relaxation and breathe out tension. So the mantra is simply a cue to initiate the two most powerful ways to regulate a state of mind focus, and physiology. Now, each emotional trigger deserves its own pairing with a mantra and an ideal response. Then, to write in column four, after she's gotten the mantra, and the mantra can be the same for all of them. In column four, for each emotional trigger, an ideal response. What would be, for each emotional trigger, the ideal response? To create a game plan so she had planned in advance what she was going to do for the emotional trigger, rather than getting triggered and falling in that time capsule, to get grounded, centered, and then engage in an ideal response. She sent me her initial draft of those four columns. And I emphasized the purpose of the first two columns was simply to cue her radar to recognize not only the emotional triggers, column one, but also the resultant state change in the content of that state as quickly as possible in order to use her mantra to get grounded and centered, column three. Then she could engage in her ideal pre-planned response for each emotional trigger. I emphasized to her that she may need to do the cue several times, even during a conversation, to touch her ring, to get grounded and centered, the focus phrase, the physiology. The more that she did it, the more she practiced on her own before she left, when she was alone at home, the more that it would create a more automatic response. And this is called, it's called the neural conditioning chart, because ultimately the emotional trigger will move to an ideal response, which will rewire the brain. But it's a hard work miracle. It takes a while. So in our first session after the Thanksgiving holiday, I was really eager to hear how it went. She immediately began the session saying it was the best holiday she ever had. There were times of challenge. There were even times when I emphasize, this is not the NBA. You don't only have five timeouts. You can have a timeout, go to the bathroom in the middle of a meal, take a walk. There were times that she would excuse herself to do a walk or simply go to the next room, get grounded and centered, in order to engage the behavior that she really wants. She was immensely pleased with her work, as I was for her. And she came to realize that previous emotional triggers, so even like things like the phrase, really now, from her mother, and that eye roll from her dad, could be reframed as the recognition of their humanness and of her adulthood. This new attachment pattern allowed her to relate to them in a present way, not having that state change and going back to the time capsule. After significant repetition, she rewired her brain, a new default pattern, to create a different response to each cue rather than having each result in a state change, column one to column two, so that she can engage in a different attachment pattern, especially adult to adult, and have it pre-planned, a specific behavior for each cue, her column four. And she noted about her Thanksgiving. This was incredible. It was really hard work. And my response to her, I understand how hard and how successfully you worked. And of course, the only thing harder, as you already know, is not doing it. So I hope this illustrates what I want to emphasize here, that what we do is based on what we associate to something. Our association, and this was simply changing an association, a neural condition chart. Let me give you another perspective on this in a simple example, I hope. There are many methods and schools of therapy and of counseling. All of the therapies work some of the time for some of the people, but what is the common element about any and all of the therapies when they work that determines why they work? Think about that for just a moment. What do you think about that? This is whether you approach it from a feelings or a behavior or a cognition perspective. And you probably saw most recently the founder of cognitive behavioral therapy, Aaron Beck, died this last week. That is the most common therapy used, at least on this continent. So, an answer. All therapies work at times, and the challenge is to identify that at the moment they work, why do they work? Because it changes the association to something. So if you want to stop smoking, link massive pain to smoking and pleasure to not smoking, or another very simple way to go about this, Dr. B, is don't have any cigarettes available. And you guys have heard, some of you have heard my story about a client that I think I call Art. I'm going to call him Art now, anyhow. Had his own company, was immensely successful, had some stints. He had residential treatment for smoking. He had 3 different significant programs. None of them had worked. And he said at one point, as we were working on some other stuff, for him, Dave, you got anything that can help me not smoke? And I said, well, let's look at that, Art. When you decide to smoke, how do you decide? He said, I don't know. I just, feel maybe a little anxious. I said, what do you do then? He said, I go get a cigarette. I said, where specifically do you go to get that cigarette? And I had been to his office compound at his ranch, and he had a central location where all of his staff and executives would work, so I knew the office he was talking about. He said, well, I go to my desk and I get a cigarette. I said, how do they get there? He said, what do you mean? I said, where did the cigarette? He said, I buy them. I said, and I knew the situation. He was not within walking distance of the 7-Eleven. He was out in the middle of a beautiful area, but not with it. I said, Art, when you're ready to consider and commit to not smoking, you will not buy any more cigarettes and not bum them, even one, off of anyone else. He said, well, how's that going to work? And I said, I'll tell you one way it works. Who knew my daughter, Lauren, when my daughter Lauren was in high school, she tried to think of things to keep our connection alive. So she would buy me Russell Stover chocolate-covered cherries, and I'd put them in the freezer. She tolerated that. And then we'd fight over who got the light ones and the dark ones. So I decided that a way to keep that tradition alive when she left for college was I would have Russell Stover chocolate-covered cherries, but I'd only have them on the weekend at my ranch, and that's it, and I'd only have 2 a day. I thought I could control that. It's the only thing I've been addicted to in my life. It didn't work. They started talking to me. They called me, and I realized that it was not working, so I decided not to get any more Russell Stover chocolate-covered cherries, and at that time, it had been like 14 years since I had had a Russell Stover chocolate-covered cherry. So if they're not there, you don't have them. So if somebody wants to do something, you don't look at motivation, not necessary. All kind of ideals and needs and all that, that's great for other stuff, but all you need is a plan and to stick to it. The pro athletes I work with, they don't want to get up and go to the gym every day, but they do because they know it's necessary. They have a plan. They stick to it. A plan was for him to not buy or bum any cigarettes. For the first time since he was 16 years old, he was free of smoking, and he's still free, I think, 8 years later now. So it's amazingly simple sometimes when we think about it and approach it in that way. So let's look at access to state, I'm going back to the outline, those of you who are hopelessly lost with trying to track what I'm saying. Access to states of mind. The regulation of feelings and states of mind involves understanding and mastery of access to a particular state of mind that is going to work and is tailored for a specific circumstance. For example, when you want to be up and feeling alive and powerful to give a keynote, that's not the same access when you want to go to sleep more effectively at night. Let me give you some examples. Dame Edith Sitwell would lie in the stale solitude of an open coffin as a prelude to enter the genre of mind to write her macabre literature. Voltaire used his lover's back for a writing desk. Benjamin Franklin and Diane Ackerman, one of my favorite nonfiction writers, wrote on a pine plank while soaking in a bathtub to free thought processes. The painter Turner liked to be lashed to the mast of a ship and taken for sail during an incredible storm and then came back to recreate his experiences on canvas. Some authors play a piece of music repetitively during the course of writing to create an emotional framework to house their evolving story. These are all illustrations of orchestrating the entry into a specific state of mind that contains the creative process elements, the deliberate practice in order to get in that flow. So then the corresponding state of mind, for example, of the reader often matches that of the author, in which the author guides that reader to a particular state through the senses, the music and voice of the words, the texture of imagery, the rhythm of feelings. Now, again, the most natural and simple way of regulating state change is distraction. Think about an inconsolable infant. Nobody and nothing can get him to stop crying. But suddenly you jangle car keys and boom, infant's in a totally different state. So we each have different ways to reconnect mind and body, such as getting grounded in physical activity, a walk outdoors, a warm bath, breathing exercises. So we're going to discuss a bit more about how to do this with clients. The most important thing I believe that we can do to achieve success is to manage emotions and regulate states of mind. And I touched a bit on this. A couple of recent studies, Harvard Business Review and Scientific American Mind, showed that the most fundamental success factor for executives is self-reflection and regulating states of mind, which includes managing emotions. Now, that was because they only studied executives. I think it's true for everyone across the board. It's going to be one of the most fundamental things that we can do with our clients. So, another question. What do these people have in common? John Belushi, Marilyn Monroe, Elvis Presley, Janis Joplin, F. Scott Fitzgerald, Kurt Cobain. They never learned the critical success strategy of managing their states of mind. They would use drugs or alcohol or some addictive substance or process or person to regulate a state of mind and manage emotion that can lead to significant compromises. So again, the two fundamental ways to regulate a state of mind are focus and physiology. Physiology, how you use your body, like a deep breath in to create relaxation, breathing out any tension, and a focus phrase, which aligns the energy field of the brain. Now, an example some of you have heard, but it's a distinct and specific example. When Southern Utah University's new basketball coach, Roger Reed, arrived, his team ranked 217 in his division nationwide. There were 217 teams in his division nationwide. So at practice, he had the players do this as they practiced the free throw to develop a mantra, a cue, which he suggested they dribble the ball a couple of times, a focus phrase while they were dribbling the ball, and he suggested relaxed and smooth, And at the same time, to take a deep breath in, breathe in relaxation, and breathe out any tension. So this would take 2-3 seconds while they were doing that. And I'll bet it's what the successful free throw shooters do that you see on TV. Now, he also instituted something that is so crucial for deliberate practice, to simulate the conditions under which you'll perform. He would blow the whistle during the middle of a scrimmage and have somebody go to the line, shoot a free shot, and use the mantra. If they made it, they got a breather. If they didn't, they took 4 laps. Now, this is exactly the simulation of a game condition. After 2 years, they were number one in their division nationwide. So mantras can calm as well as keep you from overthinking, but mostly just immediately access the state of mind, which contains the skill, the creative ability. For them, it was the specific, deliberate practice of shooting a free shot. So what we associate to a stimulus is what determines our behavior. This is what was behind my mentioning about the findings of the one common thing of any of the therapies or other interventions at work. It changes what you associate to. So what you think in your head, the meaning you give, determines your behavior. So, and there are two forces behind all behavior: the need to avoid pain, to move away to prevent pain, and the desire to gain pleasure, to move toward a gain, a pleasure. So this is important to understand in terms of how our brains work. We talked earlier about so many of the changes that we attempt or strategize are contrary to how the mind and brain work. So why not look at things that are consistent with and in the flow of brain and performance and mind sciences that are going to be helpful? So to gain or prevent pain moves us in every personal and business decision. Examples of gain: promotion, make more money, improve our lives, get what we want or deserve. Examples of preventing pain: to simply avoid change because that creates discomfort, to buy insurance, to save money, to stay away from something we're afraid of. So to change your behavior, you have to change what you link to pleasure and what you link to pain. The need to avoid pain is usually greater than the need for pleasure, and this drives a lot of human behavior. For example, the loss aversion findings that the brain registers about twice as much pain with the loss of $100 as it does the gain of $100. So one way to think about it: if you're not doing something you want or need to do, link more pain with doing it than not doing it. If you don't have enough money or money that you want, somewhere in your unconscious mind, you link greater pain to getting it or having it. Now, this doesn't make sense, but this shadow story may operate unconsciously, because the surface story is, I want to generate more income and create wealth. But if the maybe unconscious, maybe not as unconscious as you would like it to be, shadow story that can go the other direction will be something like, well, you know, if I really put myself out and try my hardest and fail, I'll be really embarrassed. Or, I don't think it's spiritual to have money. I was just never meant to have money. And if that shadow story goes in the opposite direction of the surface story, there's a stuckness. So if you're sabotaging or not attaining success in any area of your life, look at the approach: wanting pleasure and avoidance, having fear. So this is important. Another area that it's important is playing to win, which is seeking pleasure, versus playing to lose, playing not to lose, which is avoiding pain. The most classic and simple story is from soccer, where a penalty shot, if it is to avoid losing, if it will create a tie, versus if the team is even and the penalty shot will create a win if it's made, guess what happens? Same distance of the goal, same size of the goal, same ball. When it's playing to win, there's an almost 25% greater chance of making it when it's playing to win versus playing to lose, playing not to lose. And every other variable is the same. So for any situation, there are three components: state, story, and strategy. State management, I believe, is the most common aspect, the most important aspect, to choose the mindset that matches a successful outcome. And story is the organizer of what we do, the theme and storylines of what we're pursuing. For example, for Martin Luther King, his story was, I have a dream. Strategy is to move beliefs and behavior to a successful performance. People, we often start, and I notice this, those of you who have trained with me will hear my redundant voice in your memory. When you began work with a client and find out what they want to focus on, first and most important is state. Resonate empathically with their experience and try to find some way of capturing this. Just as, you know, I understand how upsetting this is, or, you know, I hear that it's very preoccupying. That way, you have resonated with their state and they're much more ready from that common ground to then go into strategy and story than if you try to immediately go into strategy and figure out ways around it. So how do you condition yourself to make changes that last? It's fairly simple and can be reduced to three steps. Identify what to change. You've got to get to the point where you feel you must change something. Change it now, and that you can change it. Must, can, and will change it. And it has to feel also that not changing would ultimately be more painful than the immediate pain of the change process. Always remember, with every client and every step ahead that involves change, there is some discomfort, some trepidation, uncertainty, and appreciate that, and even when it's evident, resonate with that. Because this is helping them to be more empathic with themselves, to appreciate their experience, and it will help both of you in transforming that change into a permanent operating model of how they are and who they are when they do things differently. That's identity. And that's the most powerful force of the human psyche. We always return to our identity. So if a change is simply a change and it's not incorporated into a transformation of the operating model of identity, we'll revert back to where things were before. This is something we want to appreciate. We'll return to that. Second, interrupt the existing pattern. You can't just lop something on the top of what already exists. Think about it. You add a health club membership. You know, that's probably not going to do it. If you interrupt the existing pattern, in other words, undo and unlearn, you have a way then to create a new pattern, a new behavior sequence. So for the first, let me back up. Here's some questions for the first step. If you don't change your pattern, what will be the consequences? What's the pain associated to a current choice that you have now? What will be the pleasure with changing? So simply, the way we can do this with a client is, what's the greater pain if you don't change? And what's the greater pleasure if you do? Questions for interrupting the existing pattern. What are the cues or the triggers for this automatic pattern that is no longer unconscious because we've consciously recognized it and talked about it? And think of ways to interrupt the pattern once you've identified it. And the third step, create a new association that empowers you. Think of all the things you gain and the pleasure you'll have from the change. Think of and condition a new empowering association to the same cue. For example, if you're phobic about something, link feeling strong and powerful with that previous phobic stimulus. This is simply reframing to visit again what we talked about the first seminar. When you behave and feel differently, the problem dissolves into the new story. It's kind of like you get up to walk, your lap disappears. You're engaged in a new story in the present moment. So, questions. What's the new association to the familiar cue or trigger? What's the change you specifically want to bring about? And think of some specific things you gain and the pleasure you'll have with the change. Now, here's an example that I know you guys know this story, but it's such a powerful illustration. Viktor Frankl wrote a book called Man's Search for Meaning about his experiences in a Nazi concentration camp during World War II. He was a Jewish psychiatrist in a concentration camp where death was certain. Instead of just giving up and accepting his inevitable fate, as his companions did, essentially, he observed that one out of 25 of his fellow prisoners somehow managed to survive. So he set about studying the characteristics of those who survived. He found that it was what the survivors associated to that made the difference to help them survive. 24 out of 25 focused on the instant death, the inevitability, the inescapableness of, if that's a word, of being in the prison. The people who survived developed a way to reframe their experience, a reason to survive, to create a meaning for their suffering, rather than simply accepting and merging into what seemed fate and wondering why God was allowing them to die. For example, they constructed a reason for surviving so that they could tell their story to their children to make certain that this kind of suffering would never happen again. It changed the meaning of their suffering. It reframed it to a different purpose, to something that would make a difference, to substitute an ultimate pleasure of purpose that transcended the immediate pain of the suffering. They were then able to make it through and had a will to live that helped them pull through the really toughest of times. Now, I want to do a brief case study that addresses a couple of your questions about focus, about going down rabbit holes, which is inevitable, an attraction to bright, shiny objects. The two of you who raise this question, you know who I'm talking to. So I want to illustrate with this case. My client was a moderately successful CPA and recognized early on in our work that he actually had attention deficit challenges. He functioned brilliantly when he focused and became immersed on a specific task. But his challenge was twofold. Whenever there were any distractions, because he worked as a CPA, he was able to create a way to sustain a focus in 3 to 4 hours working on his computer that he could do an immense amount of work that most people would struggle to do in a day as long as he maintained the focus. So basically we looked at what works, the basic principle of coaching. If something works, do more of it. If it doesn't work, do something else. So he noticed that when there were distractions, he got derailed and had trouble moving from task to task, project to project. So, and of course, that was so true. Every time we change states, it takes a good deal of energy. So if he was immersed in something, had a telephone call that disrupted him, had to get back, it's three times as much work. You know, it's been said that it takes as much work to, and less energy to change a channel on a TV than it does to run the TV for the next 3 or 4 hours. Same with our brains. So what we did then was to create a structure and a framework to optimize his immersion. We had a system then that he would have his personal assistant and his office manager intercept all the curbside consults of his partners, of telephone calls, of text, of emails, and had a specific structured time during the day that he would respond to each. For example, he would do curbside consults of all of his partners. He was the senior partner, the owner of the firm, from 4 to 4:45 each day. So he met their needs, but they knew they had to cork it until contain it till this time. So they were even more focused, and of course he was too. For his daily schedule, I knew he worked best on an iMac, and there's some space on the left and space on the right. What we decided to do was for him to put his daily schedule on a post-it note on the left side of his screen, and since progress moves in Western culture, at least, left to right, on the right side of his screen, he put a post-it note with specifically what he was planning to do this hour. And every hour, he would take that down and put a new post-it note. So he would write out the task of the day in one-hour blocks. He would cluster the activities that required the same state of mind, including things in and out of the office. So this is an illustration of what I was talking about last time about when you want to change something, rather than focusing on the goals or anything abstract or even the process, focus on the system. Create a system which is a map, because with a map, as we talked before, you know where you are, where you're going, how to measure progress along the way, what you do each hour and each portion of that hour, and what's deviation and distraction, and you plan and structure to not have deviation and distraction as much as possible. That includes when we're working maybe from a home office. We don't have call waiting. We don't schedule any people who do repair, pools, yards, anything during that time. We don't have any interruptions whatsoever during that time so that we can stay immersed in working with a client. So notice in the case of my CPA client, it wasn't the goal he focused on, but the next step and the system. In our relatively brief work in less than a year, he went from becoming a good regional firm to a national firm in his CPA practice. So by his standards, it worked very, very well. So And let me give you one more example that I think can illustrate how to manage state-specific issues. You'll see some stuff in your outline about the state-specific issues of chokes, slumps, and blocks, and maybe a little bit to distinguish that. But let's look at a common illustration. Nathan, I'll call him, was a well-known nonfiction writer. He was just off a New York Times bestseller. But he was experiencing, when we initiated work, a writer's block. He'd not produced anything for the few months prior to when he called me. And this was different. He didn't quite know how to handle this. And I asked him to explain his writing process, to walk me through it step by step in detail. I wanted to know frame by frame his experience, what he was thinking, feeling, experiencing. I also wanted to hear, as part of this, his internal dialogue, what his self-talk was for each of these frames. He He described how, as he sat down to write, he was aware now in a more specific way. I get nervous, and I began doing a lot of different things than writing. I start wondering if I can produce another bestseller or if it was just a one-time happening. After exploring the details of this process and his distractions, I could observe. It sounds like when you sit down, you may be getting really excited, maybe more so than ever, about immersing yourself in the passion you've always wanted to experience and to expand that success. And he said, you know, that's exactly what I experience, but I call it anxiety, and then I try to distract myself from it. And we talked about framing. When you read the excitement as anxiety, it puts you in your old story. Anxiety equals danger. Maybe distract yourself is jangle car keys is the best way that you can have to distract yourself because anxiety is painful. In that story, distracting yourself was adaptive, a way of regulating tension. This perception, this coupling of meaning and coping mechanism were part of his old story, now, though, juxtaposed with a newly evolving story. He recognized his current anxiety as feeling different, as basically excitement. And he also recognized the uncertainty about letting go of the familiar. But he reframed his excitement as a validation of being in new experience, as a signpost of progress to continue moving ahead in his writing. The result, he produced an even bigger bestseller. We're now in discussion mode. If you'll manage the background noise, questions or thoughts about anything we've talked about or clarifications that would be helpful to talk about. And remember to manage the background noise because we can hear things you may not be hearing. Even movement or walking across the room with a headset will create some background noise. Questions, thoughts?
Hi, Dave. It's Carlene.
Hey, Carlene. How are you?
I'm good. I'm sorry I sound hesitant.
You holding
sure
the fort in Canada?
Yeah, we have our first snowstorm today.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, it's a blanket of white out here.
We have two seasons in Texas, hot and not, and we're just now approaching not, so I'm happy. Go ahead.
Okay, so when you asked why does a treatment work, I wrote down awareness plus motivation. And I was thinking specifically of also a smoking story, but it was with respect to my grandfather, who used to smoke. He's passed away now, but
can you summarize what worked for him in just a really succinct way?
That's why I'm saying it, because I felt like when I heard his story, it was awareness and motivation. He woke up one day after smoking two packs a day for like 40 years and said to my grandma, I don't want to smoke today. And she kind of laughed, thinking it wouldn't work, and he never smoked again in his life. So to me, when I look at that, I break down motivation to investment, pain, and maybe money. And so I keep coming back to he was aware, and he had motivation.
And that's a great story, and that obviously worked for him. I would wonder if anyone knew what his true motivation was. If he was avoiding pain, if a buddy died who had lung cancer and he was scared, or if he wanted to live longer to see his grave. You know, there's a lot we don't know. But what I'm emphasizing in my story, and especially the allusion to pro athletes and actors, you don't have to be motivated in order. And it's awfully hard as we work with clients to really catalyze their motivation. You know, their needs and ideals, when they're aligned, may create or clarify a motivation, but you don't have to be motivated in order to change. All you need is a plan and to stick to it, like Art Smoking and my Russell Stover chocolate-covered cherries. But your granddad, it worked, and there's a lot to learn. There are many ways to proceed and to change. And what I'm looking at with you during this seminar is two ways that align with how our minds and brains work, to avoid pain and to seek pleasure, but also making that easy by just foreclosing an option so you don't even have to consider either of those. It just ain't fair.
Well, I guess the only thing I feel like arguing about, but I don't want to take up everyone's time, is just...
Go ahead. Do it succinctly, because I'm very interested in what you want to say.
Well, I feel like athletes and executives and coaches have a high degree of internal motivation that a lot of people don't have. And because I'll listen to people that I know, and they'll just say things like, and I know they've taken course after course, and they've done this and that, and they'll say, I don't have the motivation. I'm just not committed. They have the plans. They have the strategies. They don't do them. And so I think they haven't either had enough pain or they haven't done enough investing in terms of money and work. Or there's something innate that separates some of these professional kind of athletes and successful people from other people.
Okay. Well, you know, and I think you're right, and in the example that I gave of the people I've worked with, the pro actors and pro athletes, they are not motivated to go to the gym every day, but they do it in order for a superordinate motivation. They want to excel at superior performance, so they do whatever they need to do, subject and subjugate their own difficulty, struggles, whatever, with doing it, the time and energy it takes, in order to get to where they want to go. So they have a plan, but it doesn't involve motivation. All it involves is sticking to it. Now, it may be a greater motivation that's beyond or the ultimate result of that plan that keeps them going. So I think you have a good point that we need to consider things at different levels, and to look at creating a plan and what someone's purpose is, because I think that's a really, really important aspect of what we do. Let me give an example. Is there another comment or another question? I want to give an example of purpose, but I want to respect other comments or questions or clarification. Anyone else? Thank you, Carlene. I appreciate that. I hope this maybe addressed some aspect. Here's an example that's very close to my heart about purpose. Meb Keflensky in 2014 became the first American to win the Boston Marathon in over 30 years. His win occurred 1 year after the terrorist bombing at the 2013 race. Keflensky credits his performance to inspiration he felt for those who died in that terrorist attack the year before. He wrote their names on his race bib so that he would run with greater purpose and motivation. And he said something like, "Toward the end, I was remembering the victims who passed away. They helped carry me through." The value he placed on what he was doing contributed significantly to his resilience. Purpose can become an orienting perspective to serve as a magnetic pull that registers on our internal compass. When your purpose is for something greater for yourself or for others, this enhances the likelihood of pushing on. And a distant light footnote here. The 2013 Boston Marathon, my daughter and I ran the one before in 2012, our first together. We missed the 2013 one because she was pregnant with my last granddaughter. And our time was very close to the time stamp of when the bomb occurred. So that had kind of an even greater impact. I know we're over time. Send me any thoughts, questions, additions that you have. I hope this was useful to you. And again, remember, we'll have more time for discussion after our fourth seminar. So any questions or thoughts, email me, and I'll work it into the discussion somehow. So thanks very, very much for all of your input and interaction.
Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you, guys. See you
now. Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you. Bye.
Take good care of yourselves.